All right, so we're in Hebrews chapter 10, verse 8. When he said above, you have neither desired nor taken pleasure in sacrifices and offerings and burnt offerings and sin offerings, these are offered according to the law. Then he added, behold, I have come to do your will. He abolishes the first in order to establish the second. And by that will, we have been sanctified through the offering of the body of Yeshua Messiah once for all. And one of the things that we talked about last time, or several times, is there are three different tabernacles. There are three different orders of priesthood, and there are three different courses of sacrifice. And they serve three different purposes. Okay? And if you get that confused, you will be hopelessly confused in Hebrews. So we got some new folks in the crowd, so let me just give you a very quick run through. The first order of priesthood is the order according to Melchizedek. There are one, possibly two members of that class. Melchizedek himself and Yeshua the Messiah. That's what the whole first part of the book of Hebrews has done, is established his credentials as a priest according to the order of Melchizedek. There is the order of Aaron. Okay, those are priests that are physically descended from Aaron the Levite. The third order of priesthood is the priesthood of all believers, which everybody qualifies for. Okay, there are three tabernacles. The first tabernacle is the one in heaven, which was made by God himself. The second one is the one either in the desert or on Mount Moriah, which is made by men. The third is the body of all believers. There are three orders of sacrifice. The sacrifice of the blood of the Messiah, which is shed in the heavenly tabernacle, and that is done once for all eternity. There are the sacrifices of the blood of the bulls and goats. Those are done on the wilderness tabernacle or on Mount Moriah. Those are done according to a schedule as described in the Torah. The third is the sacrifice of praise, and that's the sacrifice that we are all authorized to bring. Okay? Everybody with me? So you've got three different orders of priesthood, three different tabernacles, three different courses of sacrifice. They are for three different purposes. Do not mix them up. Otherwise, you will be hopelessly confused. Moving right along. 11. And every priest stands daily at his service, offering repeatedly the same sacrifices which can never take away sins. But when Christ had offered for all time a single sacrifice for sins, he sat down at the right hand of God, waiting from that time until his enemies should be made a footstool for his feet. For by a single offering, he has perfected for all time those who are being sanctified. So what we have described here are two different orders of sacrifice. One offered continuously in the tabernacle, the other offered once. The word sin is used in both cases. You can be confused by that. And you can be confused by it if you don't understand the Torah, which describes in detail the kinds of sin that the temple sacrifices handle. And that is not the same as the type of sin that's handled by the sacrifice of the Messiah. And again, if you don't get that straight, you'll just be hopelessly confused. Verse 15. And the Holy Spirit also bears witness to us, for after saying, this is the covenant that I will make with them after those days, declares the Lord, I will put my laws in their heart and write it on their minds. Then he adds, I will remember their sins and their lawless deeds no more. Isn't that what David asked for in Psalm 51? Mm-hmm. Was David under the new covenant? Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, not quite.
Every bit as much as you are. In other words, David's sins are covered by the same blood that your sins are covered by. Otherwise, they are not covered. That's the whole purpose of the tabernacle in heaven being outside of time. There is one sacrifice for all eternity. That blood covers David. That blood covers you. That blood covers the child that is to be born tomorrow. That's why it has to be done in heaven, and that's why it has to be outside of time. 18. where there is forgiveness of these, there is no longer any offering for sin. Now, does that say that there is no longer any sacrifice in the tabernacle? No, that's the whole purpose of Psalm 51.
That makes sense.
Yeah, I think you sort of need to know what the pronouns are referring to.
Yeah.
Because now where there is remission, and where is that? And that's in heaven.
Mm-hmm.
So in if you read it as now in heaven, there is remission of willful sin, and there is no longer an offering for sin.
Oh, very good. Very good. I will repeat that because that was choice. The comment was you need to pay attention to the pronouns. Where there is forgiveness of these, there is no longer any offering for sin. Where is a positional statement. Location. There is forgiveness in heaven. The place where is heaven. There is a sacrifice that was made in heaven. There is forgiveness there. Therefore, there is no longer any offering in heaven for sin because it has already been done. Good comment. 19. Therefore, brothers, since we have confidence to enter the holy places by the blood of Yeshua, by the new and living way that he opened for us through the curtain, that is, through his flesh. Now, wait a minute. You can get lost here. Through and through mean two different things. His flesh is not the curtain we're going through. We go through the curtain by way of his flesh. And since we have a great priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a true heart and full assurance of faith, with our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. And let us consider how to stir up one another to love and good works, not neglecting to meet together as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day drawing near. So again, what he's saying is you are to continue to do what?
Stir up love and good works.
Mitzvahs. Uh-huh. Okay, mitzvahs. Okay. Mitzvot, if you want to do it in Hebrew. Good deeds. The commandments of the Torah. Mm-hmm. Continue to do that stuff, folks. And encourage others to do that stuff, folks. Okay, especially as we see the day drawing near. What's the day?
The day of the Lord.
The day of the Lord. Okay. 26. For if we go on sinning deliberately, hello. Mm-hmm. For if we go on sinning deliberately, after receiving the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins. Here he is explicitly drawing the distinction between deliberate sin and those technical things in the life of national Israel that are covered by the temple system, which goes on. 27. But a fearful expectation of judgment and a fury of fire that will consume the adversaries. Anyone who has set aside the law of Moses dies without mercy on the evidence of two or three witnesses. How much worse punishment do you... By the way. Yes. What does that say?
That we shouldn't set aside the law of Moses?
It'll say that too. But it says that there are sins under the law of Moses that cannot be atoned for by the sacrificial system. Doesn't it? In other words, if you commit murder, for example, under the law of Moses, there is no way to go into the temple with a bull or a goat and get that cleared. You're stoned. Right? Mm-hmm. Anybody understand what's being said here? Mm-hmm. Okay, I mean, it all works together. It's all of a piece, and you have to understand what's being said. Yes, sir?
John, verse 26, real quick. After we sin willfully, after we have received knowledge.
Yes. The question was, is that referring to people who understand the sacrifice that was made for them and just reject it? And the answer to that is yes.
Okay, so it's talking about the heavenly.
Where are you?
26.
Okay. For if we go on sinning deliberately after receiving the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice. In other words, if you reject the...
If you reject the sacrifice of Christ, right. Well, then there's nothing left.
The question was, basically, if after having... received the knowledge of the Messiah. If you then sin, you've lost it. And no, that's not the case. And I can prove it to you. Go back to Psalm 51. Did David understand that a Messiah was coming? Did David understand the mercy of God? Did David willfully sin in the matter with Bathsheba? Did David then go before God, having willfully sinned, when he knew that it was a sin to begin with, and ask for forgiveness? Was he forgiven? Of course. So he is applying the same sacrifice again, if you will. He is confessing his sin before God, and Yeshua is not getting sacrificed again. It's the same blood. He's simply going back in and saying, I knew you were a forgiving God before I sinned. I deliberately sinned. Now I'm coming back to you and saying, you're still a forgiving God, aren't you? So it is not the case that having received the knowledge of God, if you ever there sin thereafter, that you're eternally damned. That's not the case. What it's talking about is if you reject the Messiah. And that'll become clearer later on as we read on. Where am I here? Let's start at 28. Anyone who has set aside the law of Moses, notice set aside, dies without mercy on the evidence of two or three witnesses. How much worse punishment do you think will be deserved by the one who has spurned the Son of God and has profaned the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified and has outraged the Spirit of grace?
Sort of a heavy and light, huh?
Yeah. That's a heavy rabbinic argument, heavy and light. But notice what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with someone who has turned his back on God willfully after having received the truth. We are not talking about someone who stumbles.
An argument that, no, you got to keep the Torah along with this because Torah is where it is.
Yeah, that's a very good observation, and I'll try and summarize it. It says that whoever sets aside the Torah, the law of Moses, it doesn't say whoever sets aside the sacrifice of bulls and goats. Everybody hear that?
Mm-hmm.
It says whoever sets aside the Torah dies on the evidence of two or three witnesses. How much worse punishment do you think will be deserving of one who has spurned the Son of God and has profaned the blood of the covenant? So what you're doing is you are setting aside, again, the remedy in the covenant, which is the Torah. It's the same covenant, remember? We spent a whole lot of time going over that. The covenant has not changed.
That to insult the Spirit of grace by not accepting him from a Jewish standpoint.
The comment generally goes to, what about the Jews? And the short answer to that is, Jews, I believe, can be saved on the same basis that David was saved. One of the things that Messiah himself says is, rejection of me is forgivable. Rejection of the Spirit of the God who sent me is not. And if you have then a devout Jew who understands God in the same way that David did, as far as I'm concerned, and understand this is above my pay grade, I don't get to decide those things. This is just my opinion. You know, God will decide and he'll sort that out. But my opinion is if David was saved, and I believe he was, then a Jew today can be saved in the same way. Did I say that so it was clear? Yeah.
They don't recognize him as a brother. So you have modern Judaism saying, going around saying, this Jesus guy is dead, but he has already made provision for their salvation.
Mm-hmm. And very good. Let me paraphrase that so we get it on tape. Comment was that Joseph is an example of that, and Joseph has gone ahead of his brothers to make provision to save their lives. When the brothers come down to Egypt, they firmly believe that Joseph is dead, yet Joseph saves their lives even though they don't believe in him until after the whole process is over. A very good comment. And again, understand that Yeshua himself said that he came to reconcile us to whom? God the Father. Okay? That's his stated objective. I came to reconcile you guys to the Father. Anybody who has a right relationship with God the Father, whether he comes through it through Judaism and the Torah or Christianity in the New Testament, as long as you have a relationship with God the Father, God will sort that out. Yeah?
All those sins over the last 2,000 years.
Question was, if the sacrificial system has been out of business since AD 70, what's happened to all the accumulated procedural sin? It's not dealt with. And I suspect that as they start putting this stuff together, as they are doing in Israel right now, when that starts up, I suspect that they'll probably do some sacrificial work to get some of that stuff backed out and sorted out. In other words, that's something they're acutely aware of. Yeah, Ray?
Interestingly, we were talking about the joy of salvation. That joy is not there.
Nope.
And they are suffering even more so.
I read a very good comment. And again, I'll paraphrase with an example. I was one of the midrashes I read was talking about the sacrificial system. And this rabbi's comment was, we are crippled. We have no idea what it means to relate to God properly because the mechanisms he set up for us to relate to him are not possible. We are like someone who was born without a leg, and we don't even know how crippled we are.
It's like someone born blind who has no idea what sight is, so they don't miss it.
Yeah, it's sort of like we've been born blind, so we don't have any idea what we're missing, but people around us tell us of all of this stuff that's available if we had eyes. And the Torah tells us of all of this stuff that would be available to us if we could worship God the way he told us to worship him. We can't do that, and we don't even really understand what it means not to be able to do that. It's just a profound sense of loss and sadness. And as Ray said, they've, in a sense, lost the joy of their salvation because they can't relate to God the way God says they are to relate to him. And so, yes, they'll get it figured out. I've got to finish, so let me finish my paragraph and then we'll close. How much worse punishment do you think will be deserved by one who has spurned the Son of God and has profaned the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified and has outraged the Spirit of grace? For we know him who said, vengeance is mine, I will repay. And again, the Lord will judge his people. It is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. It's, again, a heavy and light argument. If the Torah, which you all revere, was so profound in its dealing with life and death, how much more is the sacrifice of the Messiah? And we know this God whom we serve, and you don't want to fall into his hands having rejected the sacrifice of his Son. 10:32. But recall the former days when, after you were enlightened, you endured a hard struggle with sufferings, sometimes being publicly exposed to reproach and affliction, and sometimes being partners with those so treated. For you had compassion on those in prison, and you joyfully accepted the plundering of your property, since you knew that you yourselves had a better possession and an abiding one. Therefore, do not throw away your confidence, which is your great reward. For you have need of endurance, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what is promised. For yet a little while, and the coming one will come and will not delay. But my righteous one shall live by faith, and if he shrinks back, my soul has no pleasure in him. Spend a little time camping out here. What we're doing is we are going into the section on faith. We have up till now talk about who Yeshua is, that he's human, that he's better than the angels, that he's God, that he's the high priest, and so forth. And now we're coming to the end of the book, and we're going to start to talk about faith. And in a sense, all of the previous stuff is leading up to what we're talking about here. So this is sort of the practical part of it. And he starts off by reminding them, and by the way, this from here, 10:32, all the way to the beginning of 12, is basically by way of encouragement, okay? And one of the things we talked a little bit about on Shabbat, and it's worth repeating because Crystal and I were talking, and she upbraided me a couple weeks ago, where she came in and said that she was having some kind of a problem, and I said, well, let's just get rid of it. And she says, well, that's easy for you to say. which it was. I wasn't having the problem. But the thing that occurred to me is one of the things that we do, which is very, very useful, is to encourage one another. One of the things about faith, and we'll see in a minute when we get into the faith business, is when you see something, faith ceases to operate because it's not necessary anymore. Okay? I have perfect faith that Brian is sitting right there because I can see him. Well, that's not faith. And the definition of faith is you can't see it. I mean, that's one of the parts of the definition, if you will. And so what we all need is occasional bucking up, because it's very, very easy to get discouraged. And especially since one of the primary tools of the adversary is ridicule and discouragement. So, and we'll talk about that in some detail when we get into chapter 11, but you know, you're going along having faith in God and doing what you think is right and all that kind of stuff, and somebody will look at you and say, you're doing what? You're doing it why? You don't believe that stuff? And you know, you can just sort of feel your faith go flat, and oh gee, do I really want to be doing this or not? So this fairly long section in the book of Hebrews is by way of encouragement. And what he's doing is he started off by beating them up, you know, saying that you guys are supposed to be better than you are. And so now what he's doing is he's finishing up by bucking them up and giving them some encouragement, and starting off by reminding them of what they have already come through because of faith. In other words, nobody does the things that he spoke of just now, you know, being exposed publicly to real ridicule and so forth, unless you have some measure of faith that causes you to believe that enduring that is the best course of action. Because in the natural, it's not. I mean, nope. I don't know about you, but I don't like to be ridiculed. And so the only reason that you would endure that is because you think that there's a good reason for it. And the only good reason for it is faith. Okay? And so that's sort of where we're going here. And he's quoting from a couple of places, you know, yet a little while, and the coming one will come and not, will not delay. That's from several places. Isaiah 26:20, Haggai 2:6, or Luke 8:18. And then but my righteous one shall live by faith, and if he shrinks back, my soul has no pleasure in him. The quotation here is Romans 1:17 and Galatians 3:11, but it's also from the Torah in Leviticus. And I don't happen to have that citation. But again, the point is that God has pleasure in those who do not shrink back. 39. But we are not of those who shrink back and are destroyed, but of those who have faith and preserve their souls. Now again, look at what he's saying. He's saying that you have gone through peril and persecution because of your faith, yet if you had shrunk back, you would have been destroyed. Well, destroyed by what? You understand the question? The whole point of enduring this where you are in peril is to avoid destruction, right? In other words, if somebody is giving you a hard time, like, you know, a whole band of Muslims or something is coming after you because you're wearing a green shirt, and if you shrink back to save your life, what it says here is you will be destroyed. By whom? I will suggest it's by God. In other words, what happens if you continually shrink back is you don't make it. And what I'm suggesting he's talking about here is he's talking about eternal destruction versus temporal safety.